From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
The federal government is open again, but it's not clear how soon SNAP food benefits might start flowing again. So Florida Democrats are asking Governor Ron DeSantis to lend a hand.
We're asking for the governor to act. No, he's not a member of our same party, but when it comes to feeding hungry people, partisanship shouldn't matter.
Also this week, anti-communism lessons were common in schools at the height of the Cold War. Now in Florida, what is old is new again.
What they're doing is they're essentially creating an official handbook from which we have to teach.
We'll also break down some numbers about how people actually vote when they don't affiliate with either major party, and we'll travel around Florida to see how some very interesting folks observed Veterans Day earlier this week. I'm Tom Flanagan, online and on air. This is Capitol Report. The government shutdown is over, but there's still uncertainty about SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. 42 million Americans receive food payments through SNAP, and it's not known how quickly they'll regain access to those benefits. Local food pantries are helping communities around Florida. WGCU's Sandra Victorova spoke with the Florida House Minority Leader, Tampa Democratic Representative Fentress Driscoll, about what she wants the state to do to help.
Now what we need is the governor to act and try to backfill the back half. I mean, look, SNAP is one of the most effective programs when it comes to addressing hunger and food insecurity in our state. There are nearly 3 million Floridians who receive help through this program. So let's just break that down. We're talking about 1 out of 8 of our neighbors, of our coworkers, of the people we sit in the pews next to in church, right? And students who are in class every day. So it's time for the governor to act. So the state should step in and step up.
Well, on that note, you and several members of the Florida House and Senate wrote a letter to Governor DeSantis urging him to declare a state of emergency on food insecurity and that the governor should use state funding to support people who depend on SNAP. So why do you think state dollars should be used to pay for federal benefits?
Because to me, this is a moral issue, and Florida has the fiscal strength to do this. We have the resources to do this. So what is now needed is the moral will to act. So unfortunately, so far, the governor's office has refused to act. It shows us that he's not focused on the people right now. But unfortunately, the federal decision, that still is not enough money to cover everyone. And only half of the people SNAP normally covers will get the resources that they need. This means that families would run out of money by Thanksgiving. By Thanksgiving, which is one of the most important holidays in our nation. And what better way to show as a state that we care about the people to make sure that they are fed? It costs a little over $6 for SNAP to feed someone each day. $6. Aren't our families and our seniors and our students worth that?
Other states have stepped up to cover some of the cost. Are you surprised that the governor's stance on this issue?
I guess I'm not surprised, but I'm disappointed. And I feel some moral outrage, if you will. And you mentioned there were several lawmakers who signed onto this letter. It was every member in the Democratic caucus. We worked together. We demonstrated unity. We're standing up for the people of Florida. We're asking for the governor to act. No, he's not a member of our same party, but when it comes to feeding hungry people, partisanship shouldn't matter. And his response, rather than to focus on the people of Florida, was to blame what's happening in Washington, D.C. with the government shutdown on the Democrats. To me, that is just so beyond the pale. It's just so low. It just shows, man, you're willing to put politics ahead of even hungry kids. That's not right. So let's stop focusing on Washington, D.C. Let's try to take care of home. Let's put partisanship aside, right? Because we'd be working together to do this. We are willing to work with him to do this. Because at the end of the day, what matters most is that young people and that our seniors are getting fed. So if we can't put aside partisanship to feed people, then what are we doing? This is a crisis, but it is a solvable one. We can make sure that Floridians don't go hungry. So let's feed our neighbors because nobody deserves to go hungry, and especially not when we're heading into the holidays.
Are you frustrated by both parties in Congress right now that they haven't been able to come together and resolve issues like what we're talking about today?
I think what's frustrating to me actually is that I look at this objectively, all right, taking off my Democratic leader hat, but I do look at this objectively and I say, okay, the Republicans have control of every lever of government in Washington, D.C. Why are they holding out on healthcare, which is something that's very popular? That actually would be a win for them. So to me, I see them as holding things up because they don't want to be viewed as compromising with the Democrats. I think that that is the wrong lens. Anytime you are in government, it is necessary to compromise, whether you are in the minority or the majority, because the reality is that America is a diverse country, just like Florida is a diverse state, and we have different political perspectives. No one party represents all the perspectives 100% of the people. So you got to be willing to compromise. That's the disappointment that I have. I don't see the Republicans in leadership, particularly President Trump, willing to meet the Democrats part way. And that's all they're asking for. Standing up for people and their health care, I think, is worth it.
That was Florida House Minority Leader, Tampa Democratic Representative Ventris Driscoll, speaking with WGCU's Sandra Victorova. Again, while the government shutdown has been resolved, it's unknown how swiftly SNAP recipients will regain access to those payments. The State Board of Education has adopted new instructional standards for teaching the history of communism in Florida's middle and high schools. The board made another big decision this week, too, as WLRN's Natalie LaRoche-Pietri reports.
The updated standards cover lessons on the regimes of Cuba and Venezuela, as well as China and the former Soviet Union. Paul Burns is a senior chancellor in the Florida Education Department's Office of the Commissioner.
These standards provide students with a deeper understanding of how communist regimes have suppressed freedoms and how they have inflicted suffering across the world.
Florida International University politics professor Eduardo Gamara said the move represents an effort to shape social studies instruction through an ideological lens.
I don't think students are that stupid for me to have to tell them that communism is bad, but what they're doing is they're essentially creating an official handbook from which we have to teach.
The State Education Board also unanimously voted to adopt the Phoenix Declaration, a memo offering a broad framework to achieve conservative education objectives. It's spearheaded by the ultra-conservative Heritage Foundation think tank, which also put forth Project 2025, a policy roadmap for Republican leadership. I'm Natalie LaRoche-Pietri.
Coming up on Capitol Report, the conventional political wisdom is that Florida is as red as a well-boiled rock lobster. Then again, the conventional wisdom may not be totally right.
Most people who identify as an independent vote consistently for one of the two major parties.
A new online gaming site is all the rage, and its potential danger to young people is stoking the rage of Florida's Attorney General.
Companies like Roblox have become breeding grounds for predators to get to and have access to our kids.
There's some new medical advice when it comes to early detection of breast cancer.
The whole goal of mammography is to find things before you can feel them.
Some veterans in Florida are learning how to rebuild hurricane-damaged homes, training that could lead to some very profitable jobs.
They're going to actually be able to learn how to build out a roof, lay down the tiles.
And we'll join some patriotic and civic-minded folks who carefully clean the headstones of fallen veterans using the safest chemicals they can find.
So it's safe for the grass, it's safe for the plants, it won't harm them. Again, 8-year study by the government to make sure that it was safe to use.
Florida was a predominantly blue state for decades. Then it shifted to a swing state, and now it's more than 40% red. But some local elections flipped to blue this past week. And as WUSF's Megan Bowman reports, the state might not be as red as you think.
The two major parties have dominated politics in the state. From 1972 to 2020, Democrats had the majority of registered voters. In 2021, Republicans took the lead and have continued to increase their margin over Democrats. But Terry H., who grew up Republican, is going in the other direction.
I haven't changed that much, but I feel like the party has. And, you know, kind of the party abandoned me.
He lives in Orlando. He asked us not to use his last name because of the risk of retaliation at his job. After joining the military, Terry enrolled at the University of North Florida and became chair of its college Republicans. But he switched to the Democratic Party during Trump's first presidential campaign.
The Republican Party has just, they didn't drift further to the right. They took a hard right turn. They yanked it off the road, off the rails.
Terry says one of his first memories is going to the polls with his mom in 1980 to vote for Ronald Reagan. Stetson University political analyst Kelly Smith says one of the strongest influences in choosing a political party starts at home.
If your parents identify as Democrats, you're much more likely to identify as a Democrat. And if your parents are Republicans, you're much more likely to identify as a Republican.
However, she says there's been a rise in people switching to independent. Minor party registrations rose by about 13,000 in the past year. You can also register as no party affiliation or NPA. While NPA and the independent party are similar, they have subtle differences. Floridians can register as either, though they won't be able to vote in the party primaries.
But most people who identify as an independent vote consistently for one of the two major parties.
And voting in the primaries is important for Nina M., who moved to Pensacola from California 8 years ago. She was a registered Democrat and switched to Republican.
I started finding that there was never anything on my ballot during primary times. It'd just be like, why aren't I getting a ballot? And then I'm like, oh, because I'm in such a red area that, you know, it's mostly GOP primaries.
Nina asked us not to use her last name for fear of retaliation. She says she might switch back to blue, but she wouldn't want to leave the major parties. Florida Democratic Chair Nikki Fried attributes the changes to growing mistrust of traditional parties and government institutions.
People are frustrated that both parties and their views and how it's been sculptured from both sides are extreme. And so people become independents. And you're finding a lot more of this younger generation who are frustrated with the party system.
A 2023 statewide poll from the Stetson Center for Public Opinion Research found 61% of Floridians felt unfavorable toward the Democratic Party and 54% toward the GOP. And while both major parties have lost registered voters this year, Republican Party of Florida Chair Evan Power disagrees with Fried.
And so she can frame it any way she wants. The fact is, Republicans are adding voters, Democrats are losing voters, and Republicans are winning on the battlefield of ideas.
Since last year, Florida's GOP has lost about 100,000 registered voters, while Democrats and NPAs each lost about 300,000. Power says the state went from blue to red to really red. But political analyst Kelly Smith is not convinced Florida is that red.
I don't anticipate the state legislature flipping back to the Democratic Party. However, the statewide races, I think, are still up for grabs. I still think a Democrat could absolutely win a statewide race here in Florida. I think we need a few more election cycles to determine whether really the move to a solidly red state is done.
State Democratic Chair Nikki Fried says looking at Tuesday's elections, the shift is already happening locally.
The pendulum is definitely swinging towards Democrats, and it's powered by the people-centered politics.
The deadline to register or change parties for the midterm primaries is July 20th. I'm Megan Bowman in Tampa.
Attorney General James Uthmeyer is using his investigation into the gaming platform Roblox as a talking point on the campaign trail. After concerns about the platform being used by child predators, Uthmeyer last month subpoenaed the company. Tristan Wood spoke with a reporter who broke the story.
So Roblox isn't just a video game. Roblox is an online universe where 151 million people, primarily children, are spending hours of their time every single day.
Cicelina D'Anastasio, who covers the gaming industry for Bloomberg, has been looking into this issue for a while now. She investigated in 2024 about how predators operate on Roblox.
Roblox is full of millions upon millions of games. It's like a mall for games where kids can, you know, raise unicorns from babies or fight with swords.
D'Anastasio says some predators pose as children to build trust, then move conversations off the platform to places like Discord, Instagram, or Snapchat, where supervision is weaker. Others have offered the game's virtual currency, called Robux, in exchange for sexual images or favors. Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer has messaged on the issue as he gears up for a 2026 bid.
Companies like Roblox have become breeding grounds for predators to get to and have access to our kids. These criminal subpoenas will enable us to gather more information for our prosecutors about the criminal activity taking place on Roblox platform, as well as evidence on the predators that are out there and the victims that are abused.
After issuing a subpoena for Roblox, he's also made network television appearances, ran campaign ads, and made social media posts. Since her investigation drew national attention, D'Anastasio says a number of state attorneys general have turned their attention to Roblox.
So we've also seen attorneys general from Texas and Louisiana and Kentucky who have issued subpoenas or filed complaints against Roblox in the last couple of months. Texas's attorney general accused Roblox of, quote unquote, flagrantly ignoring state and federal online safety laws while deceiving parents about the dangers of its platform.
Roblox has made changes, limiting chat for users under 13, adding parental controls, and using artificial intelligence to verify ages through video selfies. But even with those changes, D'Anastasio recommends parents stay vigilant and make sure they know what their children are doing online and who they're talking to. I'm Tristan Wood.
According to the American Cancer Society, approximately 400,000 new cases of breast cancer will be diagnosed this year. Catching the disease early is the best form of treatment. To combat breast cancer, one Southwest Florida breast surgical oncologist is telling patients to ignore the age guidelines because cancer doesn't care about age. WGCU's Jennifer Crawford reports.
So here is the heart right behind the left breast. And look, here is her cancer. It lights up like a light bulb.
Fort Myers breast cancer surgeon Dr. Lee Blackwell points out the red mass on her computer screen.
And why do we see it so well on this MRI? Because it's getting all this rapid blood flow.
A tumor about the size of a quarter, but not for long.
This one is going to grow very fast because it's in a very aggressive breast cancer. The aggressive breast cancers will come out of nowhere.
The tumor invading the left breast of her newest patient, 74-year-old Kathleen Mitchell.
Pretty much shock because I've had, decades of normal mammograms, so I had no reason to expect anything else.
A Lee County resident for 15 years, Mitchell felt lucky to survive Hurricane Ian after her house was destroyed. Finally settled into a new home, she's bracing for the next monster storm, this one rapidly developing inside her body.
I was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer about 3 weeks ago.
It is the big bad wolf of breast cancer. She got the worst one.
But Dr. Blackwell, a board-certified breast surgical oncologist, is well-armed to lead Mitchell through the fight for her life.
I'm going to use this information to help me assess her response to chemotherapy. She needs surgery. She needs medical oncology and systemic treatment with chemotherapy, and she will need radiation.
Dr. Blackwell says Mitchell's mammogram was the key to catching it early enough to cure.
And you see, here's the cancer here, and it's a little thicker and more white. The whole goal of mammography is to find things before you can feel them. Then you potentially will catch them when they're earlier. If she had not gotten her mammogram, is that she would have presented when she felt a mass. And potentially, by the time she felt it, it could have already spread somewhere else. And then, when the cancer is somewhere else in your body and not isolated to the breast or lymph nodes, then it is just maintaining your life, but you are never going to cure it.
The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force recommends that women aged 40 to 74 with an average risk of breast cancer should get mammograms every other year. Dr. Blackwell says the recommendations do not go far enough. She believes mammograms should continue beyond age 74.
The older you are, the higher likelihood that you're going to have a cancer. That mammogram saved her life. She said she couldn't feel it.
The prognosis is good if I follow everything I need to do when I plan it.
Dr. Blackwell says community resources are available for those unable to afford mammograms. The nonprofit Partners for Breast Cancer Care offers free mammograms, surgery, and treatment for low-income, uninsured women and men in Southwest Florida. If you need help, you can go to the Partners for Breast Cancer Care website at pfbcc.org for more information. I'm Jennifer Crawford.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Monday was Veterans Day, and we thought we'd wind up this edition of Capitol Report with a look at how several people mark the event in Florida. We have two stories to share. First one, it can take years to clean up and repair homes in Florida after a hurricane. This is only made worse by a shortage of construction workers in the state. As Central Florida Public Media's Danielle Pryor reports, a partnership between two nonprofits is now training veterans to do that work.
It's a Friday morning at the Home Builders Institute in Orlando, and Tim Zander is in class brushing up on the math he might need to use to build a home.
Is greater than 240 volts. That means that at 240 volts or less.
Zander was in the military for 9 years. When he left, he was looking for structure and a way to give back. He found it in carpentry.
It's always been in the back of my mind. My grandpa was a carpenter. And I've always enjoyed working with my hands.
In fact, he would help family and friends with projects. Zander's wife encouraged him to enroll in the 9-week carpentry and roofing program in Orlando. The program is the result of a partnership between the Home Builders Institute and veterans nonprofit, Team Rubicon.
She talked to me about it and said, you know, you should just go for it.
Zander and his cohort of 14 will graduate November 21st. Each student will get an OSHA certificate and help finding an apprenticeship and a job. He says he's ready to get to work. And that, according to Alex Gomez with the Home Builders Institute, is the goal of the program, to support veterans with the transition back to civilian life, an added benefit, producing more workers who can help repair and rebuild homes after natural disasters.
They're going to actually be able to learn how to build out a roof, lay down the tiles, and how to make them fortified so that it can withstand the winds of a hurricane over 150 miles.
Florida is short more than 400,000 construction workers this year, according to the Trade Association, Associated Builders and Contractors. An aging workforce, low pay, dangerous work conditions, and an uptick in immigration enforcement are to blame. Florida College Access Network's Dave Sobush says more students are showing an interest in skilled trades, but it's not outpacing the number of people leaving the industry. He says students often opt for better-paying jobs up front rather than completing an apprenticeship needed for a job in the skilled trades. Apprenticeships can take 3 to 4 years and pay a lower wage. Students may even have to buy their own tools.
I could go work in a warehouse for $23, $24 an hour right now, as opposed to putting in the time. So there's some macroeconomic challenges to some of these decisions that are made.
He says that's why the program Zander's doing is great. Everything's provided, from tools to textbooks, and it's tapping into a whole new demographic of future skilled trades workers who may already have skills that are applicable to jobs in home repair. Seminole County Emergency Manager Alan Harris applauds these efforts. He says wait times for home repairs in his county are long after Milton last year and flooding events and a tornado this year.
People are still recovering from Ian, not even to talk about, you know, Milton last year, but Ian and Nicole back in 2022.
But Harris warns too few construction workers is not the only problem. He says an ongoing government shutdown is slowing FEMA and the tariff war.
There are supply chain issues. Certainly things are more expensive now due to the tariffs and the uncertainty that's out there, as well as there were some serious delays with the federal government laying off employees and stuff like that. So there weren't as many FEMA employees to review the applications and plans.
Back at the Home Builders Institute in Orlando, Tim Zander says he's ready to do his part to fill the need.
Yeah, I would say it's in my blood, and I am really good with numbers, so it helps.
In Orlando, I'm Danielle Pryor.
And here's our second piece. Some folks choose to mark Veterans Day by restoring the final resting places of those who served their country. WUSF's Daylena Miller takes us to a cemetery in Tampa with a group of volunteers.
It's a chilly Saturday morning during the first weekend in November, and a group of 10 people are gathered under a white tent. Joseph Winters, the general manager of Rose Hill Memorial Park, welcomes them.
It's an honor to see such a caring group of people to come out and honor our veterans.
Winters introduces Andrew Loomish, a Land O'Lakes resident who has been restoring headstones for more than a decade. He's known as the Good Cemeterian. Today he's teaching folks the way the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs takes care of them. They received permission from living relatives to clean the headstones they're restoring. That's required by Florida law.
So when you go to a national cemetery and you'll see all the headstones and they're all lined up perfectly and they're all in great condition, and that's because they maintain them the way you're going to learn to maintain them today.
While the group was there to focus on veterans, Loomis demonstrates proper restoration techniques and cleaning materials on the small upright headstone of 4-year-old Gerald Farmer, who died in 1947. He starts by scrubbing it with a wet Tampico brush made from natural plant fibers.
I'm gonna get in here. I wanna get it nice and wet. I don't care. I mean, you can even pour it on if you want. I do that too. Get in there, pour it on. You need more water, you just tell me, I'll get you water.
Then he sprays D2 biological solution directly on the stone. It's a specialty cleaner, and you have to order it online.
So it's safe for the grass, it's safe for the plants, it won't harm them. Again, 8-year study by the government to make sure that it was safe to use.
Loomis says you may be tempted to use bleach or a multi-purpose cleaner, but over time, the chemicals spread into the pores of marble, granite, and concrete and rot them from the inside. You let the D2 work its magic for a few minutes, and then go into it again with a brush and a towel to remove debris, tree sap, and anything else. Then one more spritz of the D2, but no rinsing.
D2 likes sun. So we leave it just like this. The sun will bake it into the stone and will continue to work on the biological growth and pull it out.
After the demonstration, Loomis leads the group to an area where around 500 veterans are laid to rest. Linda Connor makes a beeline for a headstone that looks older and is in rougher shape than many of the others. She begins to scrub with a wet brush.
I see orange lichen. Ooh, yeah, it is kind of a mess.
She flew in from Boston, even though she's been cleaning and restoring headstones for 15 years as a member of the Association for Gravestone Studies. But she's a fan of Loomis's and follows him on Facebook, where he shares the history and stories of the people whose headstones he cleans. After a thorough brushing and some D2, the letters become more clear.
Looks like Isaac.
Across the cemetery, Connor's daughter Erin and Erin's boyfriend Sean Thompson work on their own headstones. Erin says she and her mother have been coming to cemeteries for years to look at and sometimes clean headstones. But today is Thompson's first time.
It was a beautiful day to be outside and kind of pay my respects.
He kneels down next to a flat grave marker with a small American flag planted in the dirt beside it. This is the final resting place of William L. Parker, a World War II veteran who died in 1956 at the age of 68.
I'm pretty satisfied with the results I see after I pour water on it. I know it's not as good as it'll become, but it still looks good after I rinse all this mud off of it.
Every time Loomis restores a headstone or teaches people like Thompson how to do it, he's also honoring a friend and employee who died by suicide.
I can't change the past, but in a way, I get to talk about Chris. I get to honor Chris every time I honor another veteran, when I'm able to restore that monument and tell their story.
Loomis says the best part of teaching workshops is the ripple effect it has in the community. For every headstone he cleans and restores, he says, hundreds more are getting the same treatment because of the army of people he's taught and inspired to do the same. I'm Daylena Miller in Tampa.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Sandra Victorova, Natalie LaRoche-Pietri, Megan Bowman, Jennifer Crawford, Danielle Pryor, and Daylena Miller. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.